Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 19 of Weavecast. This episode, we're talking about weaving traditions, both cultural and personal. We'll hear from Viridiana Chavez in Oaxaca, Mexico. She'll tell us about Zapotec weaving traditions. And then Sigrid Parak tells us about Annie Albers and the Bauhaus movement and shares her experiences with Slovakian textile traditions. Rebecca of Bowerbird Knits tells how weaving on a bead loom connected her to the tradition of man-made art. And in the ending essay, we'll discuss personal weaving traditions and why sometimes it's good to break them. I've been having all kinds of adventures this summer. I went to Fairbanks, Alaska, and visited the Large Animal Research Facility. There, I got to interview a woman who raises the muskox and harvests their kiviot. And if you've read the backstage blog, you'll know what a temptation that interview was for me. Lovely, lovely stuff. After that, I spent a week in North Carolina learning about Scottish weaving at the John C. Campbell Folk School, which was another wonderful experience. So I'll have lots of exciting episodes coming up in the next few months. This episode, I have the pleasure of welcoming a new sponsor to the show, Lone Star Loom Room, which is also known as Nordic Studio. Their website is www.lonestarloomroom.com. As you'd imagine from their name, they are located in the state of Texas. The owner, Tracy, has been weaving since 1980, and she is a frequent contributor to Handwoven, so she knows weaving. I talked to her on the phone, and she was just a delight to talk to, one of those people who becomes an instant weaving buddy. It's always dangerous for me when we take on a new sponsor because I feel morally obligated to go to their website and check them out. And I have to say, it was a good thing my credit card was in another room. Lone Star Loom Room, one of the things they specialize in is importing Swedish yarns. They have a large line of yarns from Bakken's. I love Swedish yarns. Towels made from Kotlin are super absorbent and yummy to touch. And you just can't beat Swedish linen. I was looking at her website and there are color cards with tons of beautiful colors in all these wonderful sizes of linen that you know would make beautiful fabric. Other cool things that you get from Lone Star Loom Room, they have 10% off weaving books. In addition to the Bakkens of Sweden, they also carry UKI cotton, Tencel, bamboo, zephyr, a lot of standard, good, solid weaving yarns. Whether or not you're shopping for yarn, you should go and look at her gallery page. She has a sample from one of the workshops she runs. It's from a warp painting workshop, and it's just gorgeous. She used a windowpane pattern, so it really sets off the color changes. And I have done a lot of warp painting, but I haven't played much with imposing pattern on top of the color shifts. And I was just taken with this image. So do go check out her website. And thank you, Lone Star Loom Room, for sponsoring this episode of Weavecast. Coming up in November will be the first annual Weavecast fundraising auction. Proceeds are going to help take Weavecast to Convergence. Our guests have donated items. These can be things they've woven, items from their stash, reference manuals. They've been incredibly generous. I've been taking pictures. I'm going to start doing write-ups. And on November 8th, I'll open up the auction for bids. And I'm going to run it for a week, so you'll have plenty of time to go up there and look at the site and bid on items that strike your fancy. eBay will be handling the back-end auction. It's solid. It's tested. It's trusted. There are some really cool things coming in. Lillian Whipple sent some of her miniature weavings. Very beautiful. Robin Spady gave some books from her collection, including a weaving book from the 1800s that has over 7,000 patterns. Bonnie Tarsus has donated some art weaving. Laura Fry has some linen tea towels in. I'm donating some weavers magazines, my painted warps, and some raw kiviot fiber from my recent trip up to Alaska at the Large Animal Research Facility in Fairbanks. That's just a sampling of some of the items that will be in the auction. So if you would like a sneak peek at some of these things as I'm putting them up, and you will be able to see all that at www.weavecast.com/auction.html. There'll be a link on the show notes. This page will be updated between now and November 8th as more things come in and as I get more information. So do check back and see what goodies are available. I'm going to ask you for a favor. I've been doing Weavecast for a little over a year and a half. I really would like to know what you think of the show. I'm thinking of shaking things up, maybe moving some things around, changing the format. But before I do any of those things, I need to know, do you like the show as it is? Would you like it better if I made some of these changes? I'd also like to know a little bit about you. Are you a beginning weaver? Are you an experienced weaver? Is Weavecast meeting your needs? Are you happy with the interviews and the stories about weaving? Do you wish there was more technical content? Do you wish Weavecast was more often? If it was more often, would you be willing to accept interviews only every other episode? These are some of the things I'm thinking of, and I need your feedback. I found a wonderful company called SurveyMonkey that made it very easy to quickly throw together a survey and collect the results. When you go to the show notes, you'll be asked to participate in the survey. And if the pop-up doesn't show because you've got pop-ups blocked, there's also a link right there in the show notes. Please take that 3 to 5 minutes. It's 4 pages, very simple questions, kind of fun. I wrote them with a bit of whimsy, and it'll really help me improve the show. Because I know that filling out surveys is a pain, I don't like doing it. To give you a little incentive, the last page of the survey gives you the opportunity to leave your email and be entered in a drawing for a painted warp. The way the contest will work is I will pick a winner from the entries I get. Then that person will be able to go up to the auction site and select a painted warp before the auction begins. So basically, you'll be able to cherry pick and get the painted warp that you like best. Please do consider filling out the survey. I would really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time to help me make Weavecast even better. In personal news, on Tuesday, October 2nd, I'm going in for jaw surgery. If you listened to Cast On, you might have heard me talk about this on that show last year. It's necessary to fix a structural problem with my bite. It may be a while before I'm back at the microphone, but don't worry, I've pre-recorded content for the October show, so that will happen. And by November, I should be mostly back to my old self again. I will be honest with you. I'm pretty scared. Any surgery is a big deal, but this one has a long recovery time. And nobody I talk to has said, it's a piece of cake. It's going to be easy. If you send me a get well email, please know that I will read it and treasure it. You have no idea how much that would mean to me. I might not respond right away. I fear, frankly, what I might say if I tried to write an email on morphine. Anyway, so please keep me in your thoughts, and I hope to be back at the microphone soon. We've got a lot of great episodes coming up. I've been pre-recording some very, very cool interviews, and I can't wait to share those with you. Next up, we have an interview with Viridiana Chavez, talking to us from Oaxaca, Mexico, about Zapotec weaving traditions. Before we head off to that, I would just like to say, Brenda, it's on the loom. People who also listen to Cast On will understand that one.
Hola.
Hola. Usted es Viridiana Chavez?
Sí, Viridiana Chavez, ajá.
Hi, I'm calling for the interview. For Weavecast?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. And you are in?
Teotitlán del Valle, Oaxaca, Mexico.
Can you tell us a little bit about the background? How long has your family been weaving?
They have been weaving for a long time because weaving dates 600 years ago. I'm the third generation. I have my grandfather, my father, and me, and I have my brother.
Can you tell me a little bit about the textiles your family produces?
We produce wool textiles, use natural dyes from different flowers, from different trees. Also, we have an insect, a very important insect, this cochinilla for the red shade.
Do you harvest those yourself?
Yes, the whole family. We are a cooperative. We are like 25 members. So each member has something special to do. For example, my father goes and gets the flowers, the leaves, and other people is weaving, other people is washing the wool. Different occupations.
What do the rugs that you make look like? What sort of designs do you use?
We are getting the designs from different places. For example, from the archaeological sites, the pre-Hispanic designs, because we belong to the Zapotec culture, or also contemporary designs, because sometimes the weavers say, oh, I would like to weave something new, something that is from my imagination, so they weave different things.
What do you like to weave?
I like to weave the pre-Hispanic designs, because I see that those designs are very important, because they have a lot of meanings for our indigenous people. So that's why I like the pre-Hispanic designs, like diamonds, the gods, showers, different pre-Hispanic designs.
What is it about the Zapotec designs that make them so important?
The history. Oaxaca has a lot of little communities. Teotitlan is one of the most important because it's one of the first Zapotec settlements.
Is there meaning attached to each design?
Yes. For example, the diamonds represent the creation of the universe.
When you look at one of these textiles, it's actually telling the story
of our people. Yes.
You offer artist weaving retreats. What happens when a guest comes? What can they expect?
When they get to Teotitlan del Valle, they see something different. This is a small community. People live good. We know each other, everybody. So when people come and they see the culture, they say, oh, it's really different from other places. So they stay with the Zapotec family. They share everything. They work with us. They weave.
How long have you been doing the weaving retreat?
5 years.
What made you want to offer a retreat?
Because a lot of tourists came to Teotitlan, and sometimes there's no good place they can stay. So that's why we decided to open this place. It is a new place, very beautiful place, a rustic place, just like the Zapotecs they used to live.
It's not like going and staying in a hotel that they've stayed in before. It's a unique,
exactly,
interesting experience. Oh, very cool. What is it like for the family to have weavers join them?
We have new experiences with different people, with different weavers. So it's very important for us. So people who come to Teotitlan, they just say it's very beautiful. So I invite more people to come to my community to share our culture, because our people is very friendly. They open their heart to everybody and share the culture. That's very important for us. And you, when are you coming to Teotitlan?
Your name, number, what you do, and your love.
Next up, we have an interview with Sigrid Parak, who's been weaving for 30 years, has taught and studied on several continents, has worked with museums in places as diverse as Laos and Slovakia to help them preserve their textiles, and has a wonderful archive of historical textiles at her studio near the Allegheny River. So without further ado, please help me welcome Sigrid Parak.
Hand weaving is an unusual profession. I'm always curious, how did you get started with it?
About 1976, I learned spinning from members of a local guild, and I also learned to spin from a sitting distaff. That was East European style. That helped launch me later into Slovak folk textile research, which was a very exciting area of textiles. I finally got to start weaving at Chautauqua Institution in New York one summer. The first time I threw a shuttle, I knew immediately I was hooked for life. I had done just about everything with yarn and fabric, but weaving was exactly what I'd been searching for, and I was never quite the same since. You just feel as though you're in the right place and you're home. You finally found where you belong.
You started up the Allegheny River Textile Studio?
Arts came into existence about 11 years ago. Arts is a teaching studio with students and apprentices, and I also do my own weaving. It's experimental and for exhibits. We have a lot of active projects, large library books and periodicals. We have thousands of woven samples and special collections of antique textiles from around the world. We encourage people to come, to research, to study. It's a great place to think creative thoughts and run with them.
Annie Albers, can you explain the connection between her and arts?
It was almost as soon as we opened. The Pittsburgh Weavers Guild were seeking a new home for Annie Albers' Countermarch loom, which was from the Bauhaus in Germany. They had obtained it with grant monies, but it wasn't weaving well, and it was taking up precious space at the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts. So as soon as they heard that arts had opened, they thought, Sig will take the loom. That sounds like a perfect place for it. They knew that the loom here would be available to everyone. I brought her in, actually, the very next day. I didn't wait. We called the loom Annie, too, so it may be a little confusing. When Annie's loom came in, we had to convert it back from a counterbalance to a countermarch. I brought in Goodwin Weisinger from Western Canada, who's a master German weaver, to help rebuild it. We spent 8 days under the loom, literally, with a carpenter cutting wood to fill in the missing pieces, which were the scissors, the jacks, a second set of lambs, and so on. Today, I think you'd say she weaves sweet. Annie Albers and her work has had a profound influence on me. Since she came in, I have rethought some of the design approaches and ideas, especially the connection between functional and art weaving. A lot of people think the two distant poles, where in fact she combined them successfully, and I've always felt it was a matter of focus. Annie Albers was a weaver who attended the Bauhaus in Germany during the 1930s. This was before Hitler shut down the Bauhaus, which was a philosophy of independent thinking. Annie was highly influenced by the teachers there in all the arts, but as with the other women, when they entered the Bauhaus, she was put into the weaving section. First, she wasn't too happy about that, and then she began to discover the wonders of weaving and was quite taken by it. Her research there and the early things which she did included soundproofing, fabrics, and light reflection of fabrics, things which had never really been done before by hand weavers. And so she got quite a name for herself. But then when the Bauhaus closed, she moved on to America, so she became one of our weavers. She had an incredible influence on American weaving.
Students can actually weave on Annie Albers' loom at Arts?
Right. It's set up right now with the Lino Twist. Even a brand new weaver who hasn't woven before will be able to do an art weaving on this. It's related to one of her design pieces. The Annie Albers Foundation told me I had to put Annie's photograph by the loom, and I have. We also have modified that and woven it as a jacquard photo. We haven't forgotten Annie or the loom. Anybody is welcome to come and tour the looms, tour the studio, tour our log home, which is pre-blight chestnut. The whole entire house.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is an incredible thing. So when people come, they usually like to go through the home as well as the studio.
Sounds like an amazing space.
I've gone on sabbatical to work on these projects like Michael Weaver and Elmer Wallace Hickman. that are in need of getting published. Michael Weaver, cover lead, LED, it was halfway between lid and let. We've kept the name from the book. It's an 1827 pattern book, which was used to show customers how the cloth would actually look in color. There is a page on my website that explains about the Michael Weaver project. I've had over 250 weavers weaving for that. We're still looking for more because we still don't have all of the patterns woven. In addition, we have other artisans, quilters, and other people who have worked with these patterns because the patterns, although they're for coverlets and for weavers originally, are adaptable to many of the crafts. And so the plan is to show that as well. The other book is the Elmer Wallace Hickman. I put the first book out on him in 91, and there's still over 300 fabrics and design ideas that need to be presented. The real hang-up before was color. Now, no problem, because we can put all of the color front and back of all of his 425 samples on CD. So it's now doable, and it's affordable, and that's something that wasn't happening 15 years ago.
The Magic of Hand Weaving, The Basics and Beyond, what was your motivation for that book?
To me, it's a form of sharing, and I've always thought it was very important not only to do your own work, but to share it. Krause Publications came to me and asked me to write the book, and I was able to include the basics with hints from many years of teaching. I tried to communicate clearly, and I think photographs are a very good method for visual artists. I need to see things, and I need to do it in order to have it set, both in my head and my hands. There are three PDF files on my website that further enhance the book. You get a complete index, you get more resources, you get enlarged drafts, things that I would have liked to have done, but we were limited in the amount of space that we could fill.
I'm interested in the jacquard loom.
I brought in the TC1 jacquard from Trojan of Norway about 3 years ago. It took me 7 years to save for it from the first that I heard it was in development.
So can you explain briefly the difference between a jacquard loom from a conventional loom?
A conventional loom works with shafts, which lift a set of heddles that the warp is put through. So it's always a combination of thread lifting that makes a pattern. The jacquard, all of the heddles lift independently. The original jacquard loom was perfected in about 1803 by Joseph Marie Jacquard in Lyon, France. He was a young man. He'd grown up in a weaver family. He was very gifted and creative and had put together some sort of little model that could tie a knot with a piece of wood and won a contest. And the king's men came around and said that couldn't possibly be done, and they hauled him off to the king. And so he built another one to show them that he could, in fact, do this. The king became quite interested because there was a loom that had been through at least three, some people say four different individuals who were trying to perfect it to work, with each thread going up and down independently rather than on shaft. So they put him to work on it, and he got it working. It wasn't his original idea, but he was the one that got the cards, which sit on the side and have punched holes in them, to rotate and lift different heddles. Today we use a computer to do that. We're not limited for groups of threads lifting. Any one or more heddles can be lifted or dropped at any time. So any structure can be used and almost anything can be woven on them.
What's it like to weave on a jacquard loom?
Fantastic. Until the development of this loom, I had always been frustrated in not being able to weave detailed visual images. This loom weaves just about anything possible. The first time I wove on the loom, I decided, well, now that's what I really want to be when I grow up. One of the things that's especially interesting to me is the fact that I'm able to work with many of the thousands of paintings and etchings and drawings that my mother did. My mother was an artist, and so were her parents. I have inherited all of this because she died in 1980, rather young, unfortunately, of cancer. I have all of her work here, which has inspired me for many years, and I've begun to work with her images and adapt them to the jacquard loom. It's really quite a thing to be able to collaborate with your mom. And I know this would delight her.
What's your favorite thing to weave? Would it be jacquard or is it something else?
I like to weave about everything, and I've been accused of doing that rather than focusing enough in my work. Weaving for me is a search for beauty with a capital B. I love playing with color. I love historic fabrics. I love analyzing them. Plus, I love experimenting. I like pushing the limits of weaving to produce what I would call interesting cloth, but it has to also be structurally sound and beautiful. I think of myself as the visual artist because I designed to create, first off, a visual impression. Color and structure are what pull that off, but they have to be working together. And then other characteristics, such as hand, those are important, but they are worked out later.
You've been president of Complex Weavers.
Oh, yes, they're a terrific group. Everyone should join Complex Weavers. It's not about complex weaving. It's about starting from where you are and a curiosity about other things. One of the most popular groups in the Complex Weavers is the More Than Four Shaft Study Group. People come into the group just to learn more, to push themselves a little further. Another is on fine threads, and all you have to do is weave a little finer than you ever have before. So if you've done 5 inch per inch, you can do 6, and that qualifies.
So I could be a complex weaver just doing 6 inch per inch.
It's just a group that wants to share their interests, and it works very well to get their journal, which is very good, but also to join a study group. There are over 24 right now.
That's great to know that even if you don't consider yourself to be weaving terribly complicated things, that you can still get a lot out of complex weavers.
Oh, I think so. One of the questions is what happens with weavers after they retire and die? Our work, our notes, our research, which often covers 30 and more years like mine, what happens to them? Do they just get dumped in the trash by the kids? Do they get sold at auction to somebody who doesn't know what they get and that gets dumped? What happens to all of this information? It would be a shame if it's lost. And we have very few textile curators at any museums throughout the country. Almost all the museums really don't know what to do with textiles, so they don't. And we have the Textile Museum in Washington, D.C., and we have this museum in Clayton, and we have several others, and we have some guilds who actually have own property and have more room to archive and put things in. But that's about it. We have done a very poor job in terms of getting the word out to the world in general, at least the art world, of what we do and how valuable it is. Weavers usually sit at the bottom of the art world's list of who is worthwhile.
You specialized in Slovakian textiles. What was the draw there?
My husband is Slovak. I thought I should know something about Slovak textiles. After all, it's the heritage of my children. What I discovered was nobody really knew anything about them. And that got me intrigued, and my curiosity was up. So I did as much research on my own as I could. I checked in with the University of Pittsburgh among my research, and down there they actually have put out a book with the sounding, the language. It wasn't originally a written language. They said, oh, we'll get you a grant. Fellowship grant was different than the normal grants for the arts. This meant that I have apprentices. One of these individuals on my team could speak Polish and Russian and Slovak and English. He's very talented, and so we began to all work together, and it was an amazing experience because I was able then to go much, much further than my original research because I had a translator built in. He could translate whole books of Slovak on weave structures. Have never been in English and probably never would have been, because everything that's ever been published in Slovakian weaving has been very small, very limited edition. To get your hands on them at all, it's still in Slovak. So I actually had built in some very talented people. Another person was an administrator. She was working with a lot of people from that part of Europe. I had all of these key people from Slovakia who got very interested in our project and putting these patterns on a computer, documenting their heritage from their folk textiles, and they gave me their full support. So that got me to Slovakia later to work with the museums directly. The more you work on any kind of research, the more you get hits, and you move forward with it. And as soon as you put it aside, it bubbles, and it kind of doesn't go away, but it says, you know, love me, come back. And when you do, that's what happens.
For somebody who's not as steeped in Slovakian textiles as you are, what are the defining characteristics?
Absolutely beautiful. This is a flax culture that for centuries was weaving linen out of their flax. They had whole countrysides filled with it. It's right in the heart of Europe. It's the ideal location to weave flax in the world. I mean, there are other places, but this was no other place turned out more linen yardage or flax uses than Slovakia did. They often had white or white on white because it doesn't dye very readily, does it? Many dye sites on linen. What happened was about 1880, the French DMC yarns became available in all these colors. and began to filter out through Europe and down to Slovakia. And just a little earlier, a century earlier, they perfected, again in France, a method where they could print indigo textiles by resist so that it didn't come out really stiff. It could be worn and not just hung in a church. The result of that was that it was really exciting because the people all over Europe began to print blueprint and wear it. And in Slovakia, whole villages did this sometimes, especially up in the mountains. Once they were able to get cottons, they began to do this incredible pickup and integrate them into their folk dress in all the villages, all of them uniquely in their own way. So that if you look at the little motifs, which are like rafters and X, or you look at these little carnations, motifs that you identify with folk cultures from that area, you say, oh, well, that's just it. But it isn't. It's how they repeat them, the colors they use in each village. Their survival as a Slovak people has depended, because they didn't have written words, they didn't have writing. It was their folk dress that gave them their identity, both for their village and often for their religion as well. They went to the marketplace, you could tell them from, say, the Hungarian people who were also in the country and managing things for the Slovak people for over 900 years. These people didn't lose their language, even when they were really up against it. They weren't supposed to, for example, even speak it. So the textiles in that culture become extremely important because it's a matter of who you are and what you are. And then in the countries surrounding them or where the villages are near borders of Moravia or Czechoslovakia now and other places, Russia, Poland, all of these other areas near them tended to influence some of the textiles. And so you get into this wonderful way of looking at the textiles as part of the whole culture, and you see the people contributing. So from the women doing these incredible embroideries and hand-weaving them and then embroidering them and then adding laces and then sometimes blueprinting and then sometimes on top of that adding, in Bohemia they even used fish scales for heaven's sake. Couldn't put on too much. There's decoration on decoration on decoration, and they pleated it. Famous laces came out of these areas. The fancier you were and the more you were dressed up and the prettier you were and the more colors you had and everything, the more marriageable you were.
Ah.
And by the age of 16, not only could the girls weave, but they had already turned out enough textiles for a household. And in Slovakia, that's saying something because they don't just make the bed linens and the tablecloth. They make enough bed linens to stack the pillows clear to the ceiling, and they cover everything. Babies and tables and food, and they have tents and so on. So, and all the rugs for the house. Usually, there were two setups for the looms, and they were a counterbalance loom. They were all done with pickup to make them more interesting. I'm better than the girl next door. You should marry me because the textiles are prettier. You know, absolutely incredible. Up to World War I, and between those years, there was a great flowering of folk dress. Then World War II came along. There was still more work done between the wars. And then gradually they got away from a lot of it. They have folk events, and the people wear their folk dress for it. I have folk dress from Chichmani, which is a little village at the base of the Carpathian Mountains. It's very exciting. In Northern Europe, for example, you would find all balance patterns. In Sweden, everything balances. It's quite perfect. It could even be a little boring, although you really can't say that because they do such beautiful weaving and very complex when they're draw looms. But in Slovakia, you never balance anything. You have dynamic, what they translate as dynamic patterning, which means that gradually the stripes get bigger and then they get smaller and little things are happening to catch your attention because the folk dress is meant for you to see it. And if you look at it and it looks too, you know, usual, it doesn't get a second glance. And so even the back of the textiles are fabulous. They're pleated and they're ribbons. There's all sorts of variations on the pleating where you bring the dress up to the side so that all of the pleating works. And in my particular folk dress from Chichmani, I was talking with the ladies there about how you put in the pleating because mine is all white except for some yellow embroidery. And it's the front is pleated, the children's things are pleated, my skirt is pleating, my apron is pleated, and I needed to know how to pleat them because I was wearing it for events. And the lady said, I knew there was a board you did this on, a wet board. And so what I did was, I said, where's this board? I was in Chichmani. Where's this board that I need to know about? she brought out a plain flat board, like something you make bread on, and she's trying to tell me in Slovak, and I'm trying to listen. And she shows me that she uses her fingernails. She wets the board, uses her fingernails, flips it up, and she does this 1,000 times, and that's how she repleats the cloth.
Wow
is right. The amount of energy that goes into them makes them so beautiful, and you feel that. And then when it's in motion on a figure, you see them dance, you see them walk. All of this excitement that's in the textile now begins to move on the person, too. So that's where you need to see, actually, some of the folk dress and that sort of thing to get the full feeling of beauty and how diverse it is throughout the land, using still many of the same colors. Red is the most popular, and many of the same motifs.
Thank you for sharing what you're doing with arts and your book projects. You sound like a woman on fire, so thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule and talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Stein.
You know, sometimes you go looking on the PodSafe Music Network for just the right song they came through. Here is some Slovakian music. This is Sardas by Blue Jar. Interview with Sigrid Parak, we touched briefly on her book, The Magic of Hand Weaving, and I'd like to say a few more things about it. This book is designed as an introduction to hand weaving. Now, the first thing I noticed when I picked up this book and started flipping through it was the color photos. It is filled with beautiful, clear color photos of step-by-step how to do the weaving. Very visually exciting. Even the illustrations are in color. Just beautiful, beautiful book. There are all the basics you need to know to weave. There's front-to-back warping, back-to-front warping, sectional warping. Although she doesn't go into detail about small looms, she does talk about other types of looms that are available. Rigid heddle, triangle looms, card weaving, inca looms, etc. She gives you an overview of the breadth of modern hand weaving. She talks about computers with hand weaving. She doesn't go into detail about dobbies and software, but she does introduce that subject to you and give you an overview of how it works. Instead of having you weave a sampler that teaches you things, but then you end up with a long textile that is just, you know, a sampler that you put in a box somewhere and look at occasionally, Sigrid has you learn weaving techniques through teaching projects that make useful items, which I really liked, because I know when I was beginning weaving, I did do the make a sampler thing. But at the end, I was always kind of disappointed because I wanted to just get weaving and make something useful. So I really like this idea of teaching through actual useful items. Now, there are a couple of things I would have liked to see in the book. I love it when an Intro to Weaving book has a sample record sheet, something that you can just Xerox and then keep records of your weaving, what you've done, with information about the threads, the warp, the weft, the set, etc. Sigrid does mention that you do need to keep good records of your weaving, but I'm just lazy enough, I would have liked a record sheet. Another thing that I think would have been handy is a call out of the warp calculation equations. Being able to plan your own warps in terms of how long they need to be and how many threads you need to wind is such an important part of hand weaving. Sigrid does cover this, but it is in a word problem. If you're going back using the book as a reference, it would have been nice to have that called out. But overall, I think this book does a very good job of introducing somebody to weaving, and more than that, really get them excited about hand weaving. All throughout this book, Sigrid talks about the magic of hand weaving, that moment when weft hits warp. You see the color change, you see the beautiful patterns emerge. Very inspirational. In fact, to make the book even more rich, Sigrid talks throughout the book about the various weaving traditions around the world. For example, she has an image of a Navajo weaver at work with their traditional hand wovens and talking about that process. And over here will be African weavers, and over there weavers from Laos and Guatemala. Not only are you getting the basics of hand weaving, but you gain an appreciation for the tradition of hand weaving, the thousands of years that humans have been doing this. She also has artwork from modern weavers, so you can see not only the past of hand weaving, but what's currently happening and get a glimpse of the future. It's a beautiful book. Being a primer for hand weaving, it does invite comparisons to Debbie Chandler's Learning to Weave, which is a classic. I would say they both do a good job of introducing somebody to hand weaving. The Debbie Chandler book is a bigger book, so it has more information about different weave structures, for example. But either book would get you started weaving. And if you are the kind of person for whom color is very important, if you're very visual, then The Magic of Hand Weaving might actually be a better choice. They're both fine books, and I hope you'll give this a look. Beautiful, beautiful book. I'm glad to have it in my library.
The 80s in Brooklyn were plastic and metal and glass. When I was a child, I touched a sheep once a year on the annual pilgrimage to the Bronx Zoo, where the farm animals in the petting area patiently cope with children who did not know of hay and lanolin and mud. We fed them sheep chow from a gumball machine. This was our way of feeling connected to nature, along with the lonely rosebush in the front yard, collecting shells at the beach, and trusty public television. Cities cordon off nature and art. Even the trees on the sidewalks had gates. Go to the zoo to see animals, go to the park to see flowers, and go to the building with the big columns out front to see man-made beauty. And when one gets to the gift shop, after touring through the history and geography of human creativity, religion, inspiration, what does one buy? The adults buy replicas. They buy posters, miniature statues, and books filled with pictures of what they just contemplated in person. They put the materials for making art in the children's section of the gift shop. Adults regret not having tried out the life of the starving artist and move on. Children want to create, to try it out for themselves. And one day, after the tour through inspiration and history, I asked my parents to buy me a bead loom from the gift shop. I realized that I may be unrealistically romanticizing the creative impulses of children. I did not walk through museums with unadulterated visions of myself as an artist. I was not overflowing with creative urges, drawing or molding clay in every free moment. In fact, I don't have a natural talent for drawing or sculpture, and never did think of myself as an artist as a child, but that doesn't mean the spirit to create wasn't there. And when I did eventually get creative ideas in my head, I was ruthlessly stubborn about seeing them through. The bead loom was one of my first craft outlets. On my own, I figured out how to warp it using thread I scrounged from the drawers in our antique sewing machine / TV stand. It would take ages to warp it correctly with the tension tight and even on all of the delicate threads. This loom was not expensive, not fancy, and not designed to be user-friendly. On my own, I pulled out the graph paper and colored pencils and started designing bracelets and bookmarks. I charted out alphabets, created geometric designs, and went to the craft store to stock up on rainbows of the cheapest of seed beads. I was off and running. My vision was that what friends and family wanted more than anything in the world were beaded thread name tag bracelets, which was surely off the mark, but I was creating and sharing my creations. I was one fulfilled little craftswoman who could make something that none of my friends or family knew how to make. With delight, I'd show them how the loom worked, explaining warp and weft, though not in those words, which were still foreign to me, and how one had to carefully follow the chart, beading the right sequence row by row. While handing out bracelets that only I could create was satisfying, sharing the secret of the craft was even more so. As I got older, I used the loom less frequently, eventually not at all. Perhaps I would have found new and exciting uses for those narrow strips of beading if I were a more adventurous or creative child. Perhaps I stopped not just because I felt I exhausted the loom's possibilities, but because I found other interests and inspirations. In high school, I took an art class and was required to go back to the museum for assignments. I had to walk through and sketch a piece of art. I had to walk through and describe art in plain English. I was never asked to walk through, derive inspiration, and express said inspiration in the form of my own original art. I was never asked to learn a craft outside of the very basic drawing and writing that every child is taught to do in grade school. I was never required to deal with the rough and tumble mechanics of art, the parts of the creative process many people ignore or forget or just never think about. The precise brow furrowing warping of the loom, the fine art of winding a functional and neat center pull ball of yarn, the muscling of a lump of clay into a form ready to be sculpted with delicate artistic hands. Perhaps this is symptomatic of our disconnect with the world around us. Nature is not just a zoo or city park, and art is not just beauty or entertainment or even history or philosophy. Art is the doing, the preparation, the sleepless nights of reaching out for the inspiration that becomes the object of wonder and appreciation. Art is contemplating the color palette before applying a single brushstroke, swatching for days or weeks until the fabric finally acts like one needs it to, or just observing one's environment until reflexes and assumptions give way to creative interpretation. The story of people and the story of art and creativity lives not just on gallery walls, but in workshops and living rooms, on canvases and looms. Continue the story. Teach someone how to weave.
I'd like to thank Rebecca of the Bowerbird Knits blog for writing that wonderful essay, and the talented Sage Turtle of Quirky Nomads for reading it in. This summer, I had the great good fortune to be invited to come take a Scottish weaving class at the John C. Campbell Folk School, which was a wonderful experience that I'm going to be talking about more in an upcoming episode. But for this essay, I want to talk about one aspect of that workshop that surprised me. I have learned to weave in the Pacific Northwest. I did not realize how much of a Pacific Northwest weaving tradition there was. I didn't think how I wove was particularly different than how anybody else wove. Going to North Carolina, I learned that different people weave differently and have different weaving traditions. It really opened my eyes. This workshop made me stretch a bit as a weaver. One of the first things I confronted was different types of floor looms. Now, the John C. Campbell Folk School has a wonderful weaving studio, and in it they have many different types of looms. The Glamacra Countermarch, Maycombers, AVL floor looms, Luette, and they had some Shacked Baby Wolf and Mighty Wolves. I had only woven on the shack looms before. The way the workshop was organized, each person had a warp to put on a given loom. So in addition to learning Scottish weaving, I also got to learn how to weave and warp and tie up all of these different types of looms. And some of them are very different. For example, one thing I wanted to learn was how to warp a countermarch loom. With a jack loom, you only tie up the shafts that are going to be raising. With the countermarch loom, not only are you having to tie up both shafts, but you also have to get the lambs to balance. The countermarch loom is very simple and very elegant, and it was a bit fiddly to set up. But I have to say that once I got it weaving, I fell in love. It was very solid, and I love the overhead beater. It took a while to get used to how the treadles work because it was more like riding a bicycle than pushing the treadle all the way to the ground. One of the amazing things of the countermarch loom is because of the way the shed is formed, you can weave right up until the knots hit the back of the heddles. It was amazing to me how little loom waste there was. On my jack looms, once the knots come over the back beam, the shed, it doesn't open as wide because of the geometry. You're only lifting half the threads. You're not also pushing down the bottom thread. So the shed gets smaller as that triangle moves towards the back heddles. This didn't happen with a countermarch loom, and I was very impressed. I got to play on a Louette and the AVL. It was wonderful to shake up my tradition of always weaving on a particular type of loom. The next was how you tie up your loom. I have fallen into the habit or tradition of doing a walking tie-up. If I have four treadles to tie up, I tie up the first on the inside right, the second on the inside left, the third on the outside right, and the fourth on the outside left, so that when I weave, it's like dancing. I put my right foot down on the inside, I put my left foot down on the inside, then I feel with my toes and kind of slide my right foot to the outside, and I feel with my toes and I slide my left foot to the outside, then I feel with my toes and slide my right foot to the inside, I feel with my toes and slide my left foot to the inside. It's like walking. It's like one, two, one, two, and you're always alternating feet. And you're always sliding out or in. And it's a wonderful thing to learn because once you train your feet to this dance, you can put a variety of weaves into this scheme. So you don't have to look at the treadles and you don't have to think about them. And weaving just becomes effortless. When I moved around from floor loom to floor loom, other people tied up different ways. For example, some people tied up from left to right, which took some mental gymnastics to figure out how to make my feet do that. Then some looms were direct tie-ups, so you weren't able to tie more than one shaft to a given treadle. When you're weaving, you actually had to push down two treadles at once, which at first I was a little put off by because it was so hinky. Then I realized that if you weave direct tie-up, it's a really good exercise for your brain because it forces you to think about exactly what you're weaving. And it's a wonderful ab workout to raise both your feet and then put both your feet down and raise both your feet and put both your feet down. I started thinking about what other traditions do I have that I don't even think about that are just second nature to me. For example, I always use a Harrisville or Robin and Russ style heddle hook. This is the brass one that has the little hook on one side and the fat hook on the other. Any other kind of heddle hook gives me fits. That's part of my tradition. I'm not one of those people who has a tradition about front to back or back to front or sectional. I tend to pick my warping method based on the project and what would work best for the given warp and the given loom setup. I probably have a tradition of colors. There are certain colors that I'm drawn to. And I bet it would be a really good idea to occasionally throw in a color that I don't use and try to figure out how to incorporate that oddball color into my personal color scheme. So there are a lot of ways to play with your weaving traditions, spark creativity, and learn new things. That's my philosophy of weaving workshops. While I'm in the workshop, I learn it their way. And then I go home and figure out how to incorporate what I learned into my personal weaving tradition. Some things I keep, some things I don't. There are different styles of weaving in different regions. I learned, for example, about orts. This was a concept introduced to me by Barbara Miller, the weaving instructor. It's an ingenious idea, very simple. When you're winding your warp, occasionally wind an extra warp thread. I know, sounds like heresy, doesn't it? Then when you're warping your loom, just let those warp threads hang off the back. Don't put them through the shafts. Don't put them through the reed. They just hang floppy off the back. The idea is if you break a thread while weaving, you now have a replacement thread right there. You don't have to put a new thread on and have it dangling off the back. And I said, well, Barbara, why do you call these orts? And her comment was, well, they're threads that I ought to have used but didn't, which was her funny answer. The real answer is that ort is a term for extras. I don't know if I'm going to carry that forward in my own weaving, but I must say that I did occasionally break a warp thread during the workshop. It was wonderful to have those threads ready to go as replacements. In your own weaving practice, I would encourage you to take a workshop or talk to some other weavers. Exchange ideas and try to figure out what part of your weaving is science, absolutely has to happen. For example, warp threads have to go through heddles. I would call that essential for weaving. And what parts of your weaving are traditions, things you have done because you've always done it that way. And look at those traditions and see if there are other ways to do it, because you might find something that suits you better. That's all for this episode. Until next time, it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Louise and Jean. Our sponsor this episode is Lone Star Loom Room, also known as Nordic Studio, available on the web at www.lonestarloomroom.com. Grant funding for Weavecast comes from the Hand Weavers Guild of America and the Seattle Weavers Guild. Thank you for helping make Weavecast possible. Our musical guests this episode were Blue Jar with Sardas and Isaac Angel with Come Away. Both of these artists made their work available on the PodSafe Music Network.